language. How can you avoid these extremes? Yes. Venerable young Yang asked Zhao Zhou, when not a single thing is brought, what then? Zhao Zhou said, put it down. Yan Yang said, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? Zhao Zhou said, then carry it out. Not prepared for meticulous action, he loses to the first to move. Realizing himself the coarseness of his mind, he's embarrassed at bumping his head. When the game is ended, the axe handles rotted at his side, clean and purifying the ordinary bones to play with the immortals. So I want to thank everybody for being here. There are some challenges associated with that, whether you're online or here in Ascento. Basically, everybody here had to carve out a space in her life to participate in a very rigorous sesshin, very rigorous schedule of practice, and everybody's doing a wonderful job. You know, this morning, everybody was sitting so still, and we sit, of course, for three periods in the morning, and that stillness is priceless. So today is the day three of the sesshin, and it's often the case that in a sesshin, people go through a fairly regular trajectory. On the first day of sesshin, people are still caught up in their worldly concerns. They're still thinking about their lives and their particular concerns, worries, nuisances, things unsaid, things undone, deadlines, and so on. And, on day two, people begin to settle into this great matter, into this mind. And it may take a while for that to happen. It may really be day three before that begins to happen. I mentioned yesterday, that when we're transitioning from our ordinary consciousness to our deep mind, that feeling is like somebody untying the ropes, And I hope you're getting there if you're not there yet. We've had some very difficult months. And it's wonderful to be back here at Murray Grove for those of us who were able to be here. It's like a homecoming. And for those of you who were able to be online, it's wonderful that you're able to participate in this. Even though you are home, hopefully you've been able to, sequester yourself somewhat. Around the end of day two, people began to experience that clarity. Right? We get so caught up in these details that are almost impossible to get out of under ordinary circumstances. Our way of life reinforces, I think, in many ways, emotional distress. I think in large and small ways, students an assignment that causes them to worry. And I once studied with a professor. Her name was Colleen McElroy. And she was an English professor who specialized in developmental education. And Colleen recruited me to teach in this developmental English program for inner city kids. And, my style in the class was very sort of like casual and laissez-faire. And I went to Colleen and I said, my students just don't seem to be making any progress. And she said, you need to make them worried. And I was so surprised that she said that, right? Because I thought my job was to make them less worried. But she said, your job is to make them worried. She said, Kurt, do you ever have a dream? But by the way, she was an African-American, very successful African-American. She said, Kurt, do you ever have a dream where you're in class and you haven't done the reading? And I said, yes, I have that dream sometime. I actually have a recurring dream, and I've had it all my life, where I'm in class and I have to take a test and I haven't prepared for the test. And I'm panic-stricken. Another version of this is I'm in class or I'm somewhere and I realize that I never finished high school. I realize, oh my God, I'm a college professor, but I never finished high school. And actually, I never did finish high school, as a matter of fact, because I graduated a year early. I went to college a year early. So I have this anxiety. Suddenly, I'll have this anxiety that I haven't done my stuff. Well, she said, Kurt, your job as a teacher is to give those kids that nightmare. They don't have that nightmare. Isn't that interesting? And so I started giving those students nightmares. I didn't yell at them. I was very friendly. But I started setting deadlines for them and pressuring them to meet deadlines or, marking them down if they didn't do their work or taking off points if things were not done. And, I think I succeeded in creating anxiety. I think our culture has learned this lesson really well. I think we are our bosses and our institutions know how to use those levers, right, to keep us uncertain, to keep us off balance, to make us worried, and not just our bosses. I think the whole system works like that. I think about students today going to college, and they have to take all these loans, and so they're under tremendous pressure, right, as they're going to college because they have this big bill coming due. And I'm sure you've read in the paper that some of them are paying like 20 years on. They're still paying off their college loans. That puts them under a lot of pressure. I remember when I first bought my first house, my only house, I've only bought one house. When I first bought my house, I had never had a giant debt like that. And I can remember lying awake at night and just thinking, oh my God, I owe all this money. So, I think the whole system sort of controls us or instills in us anxiety in order maybe to make us more productive or make us more profitable. I have discovered something as a teacher. In addition to learning how to create anxiety, I've also seen job anxiety really injures people. It really injures people. You know, I sometimes work with graduate students. And graduate students are highly motivated, right? They want to be successful. They want to learn. And they put incredible pressure on themselves. And when their number one problem when they're writing their dissertations is that they're measuring themselves against their teachers. And they're measuring themselves against like the greatest thinkers in their field, right? So, you know, they're all very ambitious, but, you know, I've seen so many graduate students who, you know, start becoming paralyzed. Like, I remember I worked with this one woman, and she was so brilliant, and she was writing this dissertation, and she would give me these chapters that she was writing, and I thought, God, this is so good, this is so good, and you know, she couldn't finish her chapters because by the end of every chapter, she just felt like it was a total failure. Like, this was a total failure. And, you know, when she would read these chapters, she would measure herself against her favorite professors in the department or some of the best people in their field. You know, she's 26 years old. And they didn't write like this when they were 26. Right? But she completely undermined herself. So, you know, this was like another moment in my education. You know, I learned how to create pressure, but I also learned how destructive that pressure really is. You know, how destructive that pressure really is. When people are afraid, when they're judging themselves harshly, when they're criticizing themselves through the eyes of imaginary others, you know, they make it almost impossible to do or say something that's really original and interesting. And they also take all the joy out of the process, right? It just becomes joyless. So, you know, I tend to feel that a lot of work environments in America are actually like joyless places because people are under pressure all the time. And I actually don't think, you know, when people are under pressure, that makes them creative thinkers or even makes them very competent. Right. I mean, if you feel pressure, you make more mistakes. You know, so what I have tried to do, especially with my students who are like upperclassmen, you know, is to encourage them to be, you know, is not to worry about consequences. Right. I'm sort of back to where I started. You know, they all have that anxiety dream, but what they don't have is a dream of, you know, allowing things to go their own way. You're trusting the process. You know, so I'll give my students something to read. And I'll say, I want you to read this. And, you know, they all come into class. A lot of them, most of them anyway, most of them come into class and they have all read the material. And they're terribly afraid that they're not going to get a good grade because if they don't get a good grade, they can't do this and they have these loans and so on. So they're under, you know, it's a pressure machine that's not good for anybody. So, you know, and they'll say, you know, basically, what do you want me to say about this? What is the right way to talk about this, you know? And, you know, I think as a teacher, you know, my job is to say there is no right way. You know, you have to find your way into this. You have to find your way into this. I want to read something you've written that nobody else could have written, you know. And the only way to do that is to begin to ask some questions about what you're reading and see where they take you. And if this process is successful, you're not going to know where you're going. And I'll give my students questions. And they read my question and they work with my question. And then, you know, as they're working with the question and they're reading the material, they begin to get less and less certain about what they want to say. And because of the way they've been conditioned, this is really frightening for them. Really frightening. But, you know, if you're a good teacher, if you're encouraging, you know, if you're encouraging and you're not raising the specter of a bad grade or something, right? You know, they begin to have this experience of putting things together in a new way. It's like they have all these ideas that are out on the table. And the very fact that they have all these ideas is frightening to them. You know, because, you know, what they want to do, what they've been trained to do in high school is to say something. Say, this is what I'm going to say. And then give me the reasons for believing that. And then at the end you say, therefore, this is the case. So you start with your argument. You say, here's what I believe. Give me the reasons, and then you say, therefore, this is what I believe. See? So, you know, every step of the way is clear and predictable, and you pretty much end up where you're supposed to end up. You know, what I ask students to do is to actually not know where they're going and to get lost in the material. You know, so what they have to do is they read this essay and they have to work with my question and they get material. They start writing ideas down. And pretty soon they have all these ideas, but they don't know how to organize them. And it's frightening to start creating your own reality, your own response. You know, that's frightening. But, you know, if you keep saying, don't worry, this is all going according to plan, you know, this is actually better. You know, eventually they have this experience where they start saying, oh, this idea can go here, this idea can go here, this idea can go here. And, you know, all of a sudden, it's like a paper, an argument starts to emerge. You know, it just starts to emerge. And pretty soon, they actually have like an interesting and original argument that they couldn't have predicted when they started this process. And, you know, the first time they go through this, it's terrifying for them. But, you know, after they go through this a couple times, it's less frightening. Because they're beginning to see that there's a process here. And there's a kind of give and take with the world, right? And the other thing they're beginning to see is that actually reality isn't something we're given. It's something we create. We create it ourselves. And, you know, this is the most important lesson. Most important lesson that any class could teach. You know, there isn't really one reality. You know, we create our reality. You know, there's not one way to, say, have a friendship. There's not like one way to have a friendship. You know, you meet some of the best friends you'll ever have by accident. I remember I've talked about this before. When I went to my first sesshin, there would be break periods, and we had a porch behind the zendo. And I would go out on the porch during the break periods because my legs were screaming. And there'd be this man in the corner smoking, chain smoking cigarettes between the breaks. And I thought, who is that, you know, weirdo? You know, who's that guy who's chain smoking cigarettes? And he looked nervous and I just thought, what a strange man, you know, he looks alienated. And little did I know he would become one of my best friends in my life, right? You know, so he was not the friend I would have chosen. But, you know, once I got to know him, he was a fascinating person. And he introduced me to so many things. things in life that I didn't know about, right? So you know, we were friends, but first we were just interacting, you know, and suddenly I realized, oh, this guy's my friend, and suddenly I realized this guy's my best friend. So there's no one way to have a friendship. You know, if we're waiting to have a friend, we're probably not going to have any friends, you know. You have to engage with people, and then there's like a creative process where you begin to have a way of relating to this person that's less guarded and more open, and the person's interesting to you, right? And that dynamic is really what makes a friendship, I think. So it's possible to have friendships with people we wouldn't think we would even like, right? And a friendship doesn't necessarily mean that you see the person every day, week. You know, friendships are flexible, right? Other kinds of relationships are like that too. You know, marriages. You know, when you get married, there's a rule book, you know, for how people are supposed to behave, and then you realize after a while that this rule book is making me really unhappy, right? You know, you can be the husband, and this woman can be the wife. You know, that's the old style, but you know, actually, when you live with somebody day after day, you know, you really have to throw the rule book out. And you might say at some point, this doesn't really look like any kind of a marriage that I ever imagined, right? But maybe it's a really satisfying relationship. And you don't have to worry about whether it's really a marriage if it's working, right? And it could be really a marriage and not working. So, you know, actually, we have a kind of freedom to structure our lives. And it's true in school, right? I mean, it's true in work. You know, even if we're in a very high pressure work environment, you know, sometimes we can find ways around the system. You know, we can learn things that the system doesn't even want us to learn, you know. And become creative. I know that my grandfather worked, he was an engineer who worked for the Ford Motors Company in Edison, New Jersey. And he had a rather low-level job, and he designed this process in his area of the factory that was really like increasing productivity, like a lot. And my grandfather, they came to see my grandfather, and they said, you know, how are you doing that? And he said, well, if I tell you, I'm afraid you're going to fire me. They said, no, we won't fire you. And then he told them, and they fired him. But he got another job because he had invented this process, right, and a better job. So you know, it's possible that our system doesn't want us to be particularly creative. We're under a lot of pressure to do what we're, quote, supposed to do, and to, you know, basically live up to these scripts. But, you know, actually that's like a formula for a very dull and unhappy life. And one way to think about Zen is that it's learning in a very deep way how to create your own life. You know, how to create your own life and how to experience this real freedom that we have, the real freedom that we have. You know, and often we are afraid to exercise that freedom. So, you know, I have a friend was an artist, and he's deceased now. But he went to art school at the University of New Mexico, and he was like a prodigy, you know. Actually, I can tell. tell you, he was my wife's uncle. His name is Paul Sutton, Paul Sutton. And he went to art school at the University of New Mexico. And back in, I guess it was in the 60s. And he was, late 50s, I guess. But he was like this art prodigy, and all the professors thought he was going to be a great artist. And indeed, you know, he was getting A's in all his projects. And then basically he got a fellowship. There's a very famous fellowship called the Kokoschka Fellowship. And he went to Rome after getting this fellowship, and he started turning out this artwork. And during the first 10 years of his life, he was really successful. But, you know, it was interesting. He developed like a serious drinking problem. And when my wife was a little girl, she said that she went to visit him. He had a studio in Florence. And she and her family went to visit him in Florence, and she said, you know, he drank a lot of wine, and it got to be such a problem, you know, he had to stop drinking. But, you know, along the way, he realized, I think, that he was just doing what everybody wanted him to do. And he started doing a completely different kind of art. You know, so actually he was pretty successful when he was doing what everybody wanted him to do. One of his statues is in the Hirshhorn Museum in the sculpture garden. And it's a beautiful statue, but it wasn't what he wanted to do. And, you know, after he got through his drinking problem, he sort of decided he was going to go in a new direction, and he didn't know where to go. He didn't want to do this kind of thing anymore. So there was a period of real, you know, insecurity when, you know, he wasn't selling anything and wasn't sure what he was doing. But, you know, in his later life, he developed this completely fascinating style, really interesting, beautiful stuff. And a lot of his stuff is totally ordinary. Like, he has a bronze statue of a bag of apples. And that doesn't sound like much, you know, but it's actually gorgeous. And the apples are spilling out. It's bronze, so the apples don't really move. But they seem to be spilling out of the bag, and they're so alive and beautiful. Just a bag of apples, right? But he has other things like that. He had a table covered with letters. And he made a statue, you know, like a sculpture out of this. And you would think, oh man, it's a table cover, but they're beautiful, right? And he had like a second career doing this stuff. So, you know, it might not have turned out that way. You know, maybe he wouldn't have been, you know, successful, as successful the second time around. But, you know, he was doing something that he wanted to do. He was creating his own life. And he didn't know where he was going because he was creating his own life. And when he knew where he was going, when he was checking off the boxes, he was unhappy. You know, I think that decision to, change directions for him was one of the best things he ever did, but it must have taken a lot of courage, you know. And nothing maybe in his life prepared him for that. It's been kind of a lonely and difficult decision. But here, you know, in Zen, you know, this is like a school. One way to think about Sesshin in particular, but Zen in general, but Sesshin is where it really happens. You know, Sesshin is the heart of Zen. You know, we are really learning how to be free, how to create our life without an instruction book. You know, so the teacher gives you a koan, right? And think maybe at some level that there's a right answer to the conflict. You know, there was a scandal back in the 1960s in Japan because koan training had become very standardized. And, Zen teachers were expecting more or less standard responses from their students. And they would keep notebooks with the sort of standard answers. And they're kind of standard answers to koans, there are. Mostly these teachers would write down the answer that they had given to their own teacher. Anyway, there was this Rev Roshi in Japan who decided that this was bullshit, you know. So he actually found a publisher and he published 100 Zen koans with answers. And by the way, it's been translated. So I even think Rutgers has a copy, you know. So if you really want to do well in your Zen practice, you know, you can check out that book and Xerox it. But, you know, it won't help in this saga. Because, you know, the whole beauty of the koan is that, you know, you don't know where you're going and you have to put the answer together. You have to put the world together for yourself. You know, and so, you know, the teacher gives you a koan and you go away. And, of course, when we try to think it through intellectually, of course, all we're doing is recycling old ideas, right? And we're protecting ourselves from the experience of not knowing, of being at sea. And, you know, as we know, in Zen, there's this whole, there's this deeper mind that begins to become active in the process of working with your koan. You know, we start out working with the wu koan so that we go to that empty place. And that's like the door to our big mind, to our unconscious. And when we go into wu xin and we work with the koan, we're beginning to activate this creative intelligence, you could say, this creative intelligence. And, you know, when you are a student writing your papers, you don't know about Mu, and you don't know about the big mind. And you've got this paragraph, and this paragraph, and this paragraph, and this paragraph. And you can lie awake at night and think, I don't know how to put these paragraphs together. But then, you know, all of a sudden, you put this paragraph here, and this paragraph there, and this paragraph here. And it all makes sense. And, you know, the average freshman doesn't stop to say, why does this make sense, right? But, you know, actually, the average freshman is guided by the big mind. You know, there's this deeper intelligence that everybody has, and it's helping us even when we don't know that it's active. You know, and so even freshmen, although they don't know it, you know, freshman writers, are being guided by big mind, and a lot of the anguish that people go through is not believing that they can do it, right? Not believing that they can do it. And because when they look at a problem with their small mind, you know, it does seem insolvable. It seems like I'll never work this out. Because after all, you know, the small mind can only work with what it already knows. So if you're in a new situation and you're in an unexpected dilemma, you know, nothing you already know can solve that problem. If it could, you wouldn't be in the dilemma, right? So you know, even students in school who are learning algebra, you know, have to actually, even though they don't know it, they have to actually rely on big mind. You know, I myself had a hard time in Algebra 1. I took Algebra 1, I think I was in the 7th grade, something like that. turn out. And I would start, to get F's, which I had never gotten. You know, I would say 7x plus 5y equal 12. And I just couldn't get my mind around that, you know? And, you know, I could, or 5x equals 12. Now, at the time, this was just conceptually beyond me. It's like, what's x? X is a letter. It's not a number, you know? And when we had multivariable calculations, I just couldn't, I was just frozen. And I don't think it was the algebra so much. It was my response to the unknown. So actually, I started failing algebra, and I had this wonderful teacher. This wonderful teacher who said, she said, I'm not going to let you fail. And she started working with me and trying to explain things to me. You know, and if you said, there was no point at which I really felt I was understanding what I was doing, but all of a sudden, I started solving these problems, right? I started actually, getting all the answers correct, you know. And if somebody had asked me, how are you doing it, I didn't really know, because it was sort of intuitive. I sort of took it in. But I think that was one of the first times in my life when I learned how to use my big mind. So, a lot of Zen practice, what makes Zen practice so beautiful, is trusting this big mind and realizing, how much wiser it is than the small mind. And, living in, living in uncertainty is really wonderful. Venerable Yang Yong asked Jiaozhou, when not a single thing is brought, what then? So, in other words, maybe you're waiting for something to happen and it hasn't happened, right? And you feel totally trapped, right? And you worry about it. So maybe you're waiting for something. Maybe you're waiting for, a promotion, or you're waiting for some new business to come across your door, you're waiting and waiting, nothing happens, nothing arrives, right? When not a single thing comes, what then? And if something isn't going according to plan, we worry about it. We obsess about it. Maybe you're a writer and you send something into a magazine, and the magazine editor, says no. And you can go through a range of emotions. This has certainly happened to me. And you can go over your article. You can, read the reviewer's comments. You can lose a lot of sleep over this, right? But Jiaozhou says, when you reach a barrier, what do? Put it down. Put it down. So when we're trapped, what do? Let ourselves go. Let ourselves go. Yangdan says, if I don't bring a single thing, if I hold on to nothing, what then? Jiaozhou says, carry it out. So, our koan practice is like life, right? Barriers, being trapped, right? You're given a question that you can't answer and you must answer it, right? Or you have a task that you can't do, but you must do it, right? And, the more answer properly or to perform properly, the more unhappy we become, but also like the less possible it is for us to think outside the box. You know, maybe we sent our article to the wrong magazine, right? You know, that actually happened to me.
Spirit.
humans and immortals. In the Long Yan era of the Jin Dynasty, Wang Shi was gathering firewood and he stumbled into a grotto where he saw four boys playing chess. They gave him something to eat like a date. After he ate it, he wasn't hungry. When the game ended, the axe handle at his side had rotted and his rotting clothes were flapping in the wind. When evening came, he returned home, but several decades had passed. See, this is like a magical chess game. So, anyway, that's interesting, I think. So, you know, you're out looking for firewood, and you stumble into a magical chess game, and you undergo